Dear friends and colleagues, I'm very happy and honored to be here, that is to say, in virtual space, to deliver this long-distance talk for the Deleuze and Guattari in Africa conference. I cannot tell you how I wish that I could be there, but okay, that's another story. I want to thank warmly Dr. Chantelle Gray and Vivienne Bozalek for inviting me to do this, and greet also my other colleagues, keynote speakers, both the actual and the virtual ones present at this conference. I was asked to address the issue of affirmation, the powers of affirmation, key concept for Deleuze and Guattari, but also a concept that is slightly irritating in the context of the state of political and ethical disenchantment that we all are living in these days. And in this general disenchantment due to the conflict-ridden, violent, and profoundly unjust times that we're living through. Just as I speak, in Greece, a member of the European Union, all the banks have been shut down for all of this week, waiting for decisions to be made about the financial future of the country. And that is plunging an entire population in the developed part of the world, so-called, into a humanitarian and human, quite simply, crisis out of all proportions. These are the times that we're living in. And yet, I will argue that we need to think affirmatively, we have to think affirmation. I will try to give you some arguments why this matters. I will try to raise some objections and then give you some examples of what we gain by embracing the concept of affirmation for our ethical and political practice. Notion of affirmation, Deleuze's major contribution to the discussion on ethical and political practice, emerges from the philosophical tradition that is known as the line of immanence as opposed to the line of transcendence. Line of immanence that includes Foucault, his teacher, Canguilhem, Deleuze, his teacher, Bachelard, and beyond them, Nietzsche and Spinoza. Line of transcendence, on the other hand, people like Levinas, Derrida, and ultimately Kant and all that tradition. The focus on the immanence, so the line of immanence, is to bring to the core a sort of paradox, the paradox of being embedded, of being immanent to situations, conditions, contexts, and relations that one remains very critical of. It is the paradox of critical theory, how to engage in affirmative politics, which entails the creation of sustainable alternatives. It includes the creation of social constructions of horizons of hope, while at the same time developing schemes of resistance that are opposed to the injustices of the present. So how to resist the presence, more specifically the injustice, violence, and vulgarity of the times, while being worthy of our times, that is to say, engage with them, understand that we are part of the problems that we are trying to solve, that we are not external to the very relations that we are commenting on critically. I would also translate this paradox, this issue, in terms of the relationship between critique on the one hand and creation on the other. That is to say, how to balance the creative potential of critical thought with the dose of negative criticism, a certain amount of oppositional consciousness that is necessarily at stake in the exercise. Deleuze and Guattari address this issue in What is Philosophy when they talk about the parallelism between arts, science, and philosophy in terms of the relationships between critique and creativity. And in the notion and the practice of radical immanence includes not only the elements of reason and thought and thinking, but also affirmative, affective, passions, ethical relations. Affectivity is part of this deal as much as definitions of what it means to think. Another element that I use in trying to bring the notion of both affirmation and immanence down to earth is the feminist politics of locations. very important concept developed by Adrienne Rich in the 1980s already. It is a method for grounding activism. A location is an embedded and embodied memories. It is, in fact, to quote Foucault, a set of counter-memories which are activated by the resisting thinkers against the grain of the dominant social representations of identity, subjectivity, and intersubjectivity. A location is also a materialist temporal and spatial site of co-production of the subjects in their diversity. Accounting for this complexity is therefore a way of grounding the power relations in something that we can work with, in something tangible. Politics of location provide the grounds for ethical and political accountability, and they include a relationship to time, to memory, as well as to spaces and location. I think that the notion of memory is extremely important here, because a memory is, first of all, an ecology of belonging. And a memory is a very embodied and a very singular set of associations. No memories are alike. And memories are also intergenerational and I would argue, interspecies. And the genetic code is the accumulated memory of our species. And it stretches across other species as well. And it unfolds its signal and its code without any major intervention from the rational functions. And memories are also intergenerational if you read them with Freud and particularly the first generation of psychoanalysis. Unconscious memories mean that we remember things that may not even have happened to us. And in fact, Cornel West, in his work on memory and oppositional consciousness or critical consciousness, Cornel West argues that critical thinkers are people that remember the great injustices, the horrors of histories, some of which may or may not have happened to them directly. So politics of location is an ecology of belonging. It's a way of accounting for what makes you tick, what makes you want to think about horrors, injustices, violences, whether they have happened to you personally or not. Memory is really an ecology of belonging. The work of memory, reread by Deleuze and Guattari with the philosophy of time of Bergson, is very important to the task of dealing with the political and ethical material, which is what critical thinkers are all about. And Deleuze inherits also another final important method from his friend, predecessor, Michel Foucault, and that is the idea of power as both positive and negative, potestas and potentia, the power that constrains you, the power that empowers you, and that power as a system, a web of interrelations that we need to account for, multiple locations that we need to account for through cartographic methods. And cartographies become diagrams for Deleuze and Guattari, and they remain politically informed mapping of one's historical, social, temporal locations. Cartographies of power are counter-memories. They are genealogies of forms of resistance. They allow us to draw diagrams of the present in order to resist the present by the same means. They are immanent analyses of the singular actualizations of concrete power formations. So here we have the political punchline, if you wish, of this set of premises. And they come to bear on two crucial ideas for Deleuze and Guattari, which are the critique of the self-other dialectics on the one hand, and the rejection of the notion of difference as pejoration on the other. So no dialectics and no negative difference. We will get instead, as I will argue in a minute, we will get monism instead of the dialectics and the positivity of difference instead of the negativity. I don't have to tell you much about dialectics. We are in Cape Town, you know that better than most. And dialectically defined as other than, difference has always been inscribed in a hierarchical scale of social relations that simply spells inferiority. To be different, it is to be different from a norm. That norm is, according to Deleuze and Guattari, white, masculine, heterosexual, urbanized, speaking a standard language, owning legally the women and the children, and so on and so forth. That's what they call the majoritarian man with a capital M. To be different from, other than, the norm defined as this vision of the human man means to be worth less than that norm. So a norm defines itself as much by what it excludes as by what it includes in itself. Definition: to be other than is to be worth less than. And some in some episodes of European history, to be worth less than pushed entire sectors of the population outside of citizenship. This was the case for women, for children, for Jewish, for inhabitants of the European population. And it was absolutely true for all the colonial population. To be other than Europeans means to be less than, and in some cases it meant to be less than human itself. There is an attribution of being human here that is based on a normative vision of what constitutes as the human, essentially white European male. Everything else is slightly less than human, slightly less than that norm. So you get a real focus here on that normative vision of the human, that normative vision of man, as something that that exercises extraordinary epistemic violence, as Spivak would say, against entire sectors of the population that don't fall within that, and that become marked as negative others and less than, and not only different from equals less than. So hierarchical attributions of belonging to the norm and difference here as a factor of pejoration. And this has marked off sectors of sexualized, racialized, naturalized others whose social and symbolic existence is disposable and unprotected. And because of their history in Europe and elsewhere, has been one of lethal exclusions and fatal disqualifications, these others really raise critical issues of power and domination, not only in world historical events, but also in the practice of reason, in the practice of thinking, in the very act of talking about an entity that we may call humanity or the human. As a reminder, most of the radical social movements of the second half of the last century were fueled by the insurgent structural others of the Western subject of modernity, the women's rights movements, LGBT movements, the anti-racism and decolonization movements, the anti-nuclear, anti-war, pro-environmental movements, to name just two or three of them. These are the voices of the sexualized, racialized, naturalized others of modernity that mark the crisis of the dominant subject positions, but they also express new patterns of becoming of the minority. Crisis of the majority, patterns of becoming of the minorities. And they, through a very grounded, imminent cartographies of power, they actually expose power relations in the making of the very categories that we use to apprehend and comprehend the world, the human, the citizen, man, the others. So difference here is becomes a very problematic, highly rigorously reanalyzed concept. It is about embracing difference with the explicit aim of making it function differently from the dialectics and the binary oppositions, so that it can actually circulate in a non-hierarchical manner as a multi-layer concept, and that becomes nomadic and productive. This is very important to understand, of course, how affirmation gets built. So we've had so far the rejection of the dialectics and the paradox of a critical theory that needs to embrace our modes of belonging to the world, the politics of location, spatial and temporal, but embrace them in order to resist them, in order to find ways of making a difference to that very world that we are involved in. As Donna Haraway put it, some differences are playful, some are poles of world historical systems of domination. Epistemology is about knowing the difference. Critical theory is about knowing the difference. So the affirmative, the case for affirmation, building on these premises, then assumes the other crucial idea, the opposition to the dialectics, monistic relational ontology. Monistic ontology means that matter is one intelligence and self-organizing or autopoietic. This is a neo-Spinozist approach that actually opposes the whole Hegelian legacy of dialectics. 1979, Pierre Macheret wrote a very important book, Hegel or Spinoza. It was in the beginning of what people call the French Spinoza movement, late 1970s in Paris. The students of Althusser switched from reading Hegel and Marx. They're also reading Hegel and Marx, but they also focus on reading Spinoza, looking for alternative to the dialectic. That book by Pierre Macheret was translated into English in 2011 from 1979 under the impact of the enormous global interest in Deleuze's thought. I recommend it very highly. So that living matter as one functions by modulating different organisms and entities which can be called variations on a common theme. Deleuze calls it the university of being. Given that Spinoza defines the core or the essence of the subject as positivity, here we have again the terms of positivity. Positivity in the sense of conatus, conatus being the ontological desire to express everything that one is capable of. Express one's capacity, the freedom of what a body can do. And a body here is not a Cartesian dualistic entity. It is an embedded and embodied, embrained, affective, relational entity of what a body thus defined can do. In formulating such a problem, then, the issue of the negative difference of spiration becomes a false problem that must be subjected to the primacy of the positive. This is a huge issue, and the issue of the relationship between an idea of the human subject as fundamentally positive, conatus, prone to desire, the desire to express the profound freedom that inhabits us, as opposed to a negative understanding of the subject as ridden by guilt or by innate violence. This is the model that we get in Hobbes, in Locke. The model of the social contract is a model of trading that assumes that the state is there to redeem the humans from the brutality and violence of the state of nature. That is the social contract theory. In Spinoza, we have a very different politics. This is a man who wrote during the Dutch Republic, who saw the magnificent that was power to the people and the power of the people, although the people were limited to certain classes in the Dutch Republic, but nonetheless, he's a man who is actually thinking radical democracy. And the positive idea of the subject is actually echoed in Spinoza's work by an understanding of the state as a mechanism of capture that reduces and constrains and confines what we're capable of. And you will get this idea that the state is actually, in a sense, a filter, a mechanism that reduces you. You get this very strongly in the work of contemporary Spinozists like Tony Negri and Michael Hart in Empire and Beyond, where in some ways the state is the enemy and the multitudes represent the freedom of collective subjects that are longing to express their desire to be. Deleuze does not go towards that sort of revolutionary romanticism, if I may say so. They're a lot more careful, Deleuze and Guattari, in inscribing this monistic ontology, this neo-materialist philosophy, in a relational ethical bond. Being made of the same matter, being beyond the dialectic, means that we are all interrelated in a multiplicity of ways. And this interrelation does not concern only the humans, but massively for Spinoza, our relationship to the environment as a whole. We consume the resources of the planet at every single instance of our existence. And here we have to think very much of the work that Guattari did in pushing the monistic philosophy, the classical monistic philosophy of Spinoza, in the direction of ecosophy, that is to say, environmentalism, that is to say, we are consuming air and water and earth and the products of the earth. We are consuming social products. We are consuming right now high technologies, but we are saving on carbon trace, so we're actually very virtuous. But we're consuming multiple ecologies, psychic ecologies, argue Guattari, social ecologies, environmental ecologies. We are part of a nature-culture continuum. We are in this together. So what emerges from this is a collectively distributed consciousness, a transversal form of non-synthetic understanding of the relational bond that connects us. And one of the ways in which you can enter this discussion on monism and the positivity of a differential system of specifications of identities is through contemporary neurosciences. Think of the work of Antonio Damasio, Looking for Spinoza, Descartes' Error. I think neurosciences at the moment are a very good way to enter this conversation. This collective subject, then, is a relational process of becoming nomadic. This is exactly everything I try to do with my work on nomadic subjects. Nomadic, rhizomic, relational, this subject does not pre-exist the relations that actualize it. But it is neither born of nor exhausted by just a performative gesture. It is a subject that gets expressed or dramatized and coalescing around affectivity, that is to say, the actualization of desire as plenitude, desire as the actualization of multiple virtualities. So again, embodied, embedded, in flesh, affective, relational, right here and right now. So here we go, the opposition to the dialectic. Out goes the self-other, the master-slave. Out goes negativity of difference and the hierarchical relations, the rest upon it. And out goes the idea of critical theory as necessarily only negative, only oppositional, as something that, in a sense, would abstract the critical thinker from the very conditions that she is trying to criticize. I think you need to focus on this because it is of the greatest importance for our practice as thinkers, as teachers, as researchers, that we are part of the problems that we're trying to solve, and the fact that we may be against, let's do it in order, capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, violence, the fact that we are against, that we have an oppositional consciousness, does not abstract us from the conditions that we are critical of. We are not transcendental entities standing above the horrors of capitalism and colonialism, issuing normative injunctions. We are immanent to the conditions of power that we are criticizing. So here we have Foucault's dilemma when he became professor at the Collège de France, which is like the equivalent of ascending to Mount Olympus at the age of 30 nothing. And he wrote his inaugural lecture and he said, here I am, a professor at the Collège de France, practically immortal, not quite, but almost. And what will I do with the great power that I'm given, well, I will use this power to critique a certain understanding of the professor as a demigod, as a demigod, also as a demagogue, but it's not bad, but demigod. The professor as a judge, the professor as the legislator of truth, the professor who can tell you what is right and what is wrong, what is true science, what is just gossip. That idea, the Kantian idea of the judge of thought, the judge in thinking. Foucault takes that and says, this is not how I'm going to do this. I will show you the complicated imbrications of power and desire that make formations of discourse possible. And this, for Deleuze, is absolutely a point of non-return. Then we have a concomitance between the conditions that one inhabits and the conditions that one is critical of. And this means that negativity is part of the exercise. Of course, we're against. But that moment, I would call it an analytical function of negativity, is only a moment. The proper job, the task, the ethical obligation is in reversing the negative into conditions of affirmation and positivity. I shall return to this. But we need for the moment to focus on this because it is in some ways the most radical conceptual critiques of Marxism, the Hegelian roots of Marxism. That is to say that it is indeed the same material and discursive conditions that require the negative moment, for instance, the experience of oppression, marginality, injury, or trauma. These conditions are the stuff that we are dealing with. This is what critical theory is all about. But they are also the conditions that we need to transform or reverse. In a dialectical system, this reversal is in some ways automatic because there is a philosophy of history, philosophy of time at work, inherited from Hegel, that would make thesis, antithesis, synthesis part of the exercise. In a monistic philosophy, the task of transforming the negative conditions into affirmative is a praxis that needs to be led by a clear ethics of affirmation. It is our ethics that actually give us the politics in a Spinoza's scheme, the ethics being the active pursuit of conditions and relations of positivity. So the task of negativity is analytic. It allows us to reject events or ideas that we find unsatisfactory. It can be normative because the gesture of negation defines our politics, but that gesture of negation is never political enough in a Deleuzean, Guattarian, Spinozist. Just being against may make you feel good, but it is actually rhetorical posturing with very little substance. It is what we make of that oppositional consciousness that matters. And in the making, we are already reversing the negative into an affirmative gesture, embracing the very conditions that we're critical of. So whereas Hegelian critical theory requires negativity, almost perversely, because negativity engenders oppositional consciousness, in monism, we actually reverse the perspective. And what we start with is Deleuze's famous formula in Bartleby's words, I would prefer not to. That is to say, stating a critical distance as a positive, not as a negation. So it's not as if Deleuze discards negation, but uses it differentially. And he attacks the idea that critical theory consists in basically legislating about the negative. I may remind you here of the great lesson of Nietzsche on the negativity of the priest, of the judge, of the herd, of the subjugated individual. So the shift of perspective that we need here requires philosophical monism, and the recognition of affectivity as a component of subjectivity. We are desiring subject. What we desire is the expression of our power as potentia. And this is a sort of a radical relationality aiming at affirmative empowerment, which is the ethical good. It is the ethical ideal for Spinoza as for Deleuze. So oppositional consciousness here becomes, on the contrary, the consciousness, the awareness of modes of belonging, and that mode of belonging requires a humble acceptance that we need to work with what we've got. We need to work with even the negative instances and see how we can overturn them to our best advantages. Conceptually, this means that the conditions for political and ethical agency are not dependent, for Deleuze and Guattari, on the current state of the terrain. They are not oppositional in the sense of being tied to the present by negation. They are, on the contrary, affirmative. And this means geared to the creation of possible futures. Ethical and political relations create possible worlds by mobilizing resources that have not yet been used, tapped, or sometimes even recognized or seen. So the work of critique must focus on creating the conditions for the overturning of negativity precisely because they are not immediately available in the present. Moving beyond the dialectical schemes of thought means abandoning oppositional thinking so as to index the critical activity in the present upon the construction of sustainable possible future. The sustainability of the future rests on our collective ability to mobilize, actualize, and deploy cognitive, affective, ethical forces that have not yet been activated so far. These driving forces concretize in actual material relation and thus constitute a network web of rhizome of interconnection with multiple others. So we need to think differently about ourselves, and to think means to create new conceptual tools that may enable us to both come to terms and to actively interact with multiple empowering others, not all of them human others. This ethical gesture is the actualization of our increased ability to act on and interact with the world. So there is a political necessity to develop what Spinoza calls adequate understandings of our real life conditions so that we can map out the negative instances, turn them into the meta that critical theory has to engage with. And in this process, we turn these negative instances into the sources of counter-truths and values, speaking like Foucault, or into moments that trigger the desire to actualize virtual possibilities, that's more Deleuze's language, and the work of critical theory is to elucidate, clarify, facilitate this ethical process of transformation. Notice that crucial to this is the non-human others. And this is not only about human liberations and anthropocentric subject, this is about a multitude of subjects. Rethink back to the three ecologies of Guattari and remember that Spinoza has always been a source of inspiration for the environmental movement, even before the French reread Spinoza, certainly before Deleuze. The first Gaia generation are classical Spinozists, and they believe that all that lives has intelligence and is in some ways holy, and from there they developed powerful ecological thought processes and movements. And so non-humans are involved in this, this would open the whole discussion on the posthuman, which is for another time. So what is positive in the ethics of affirmation is the actual belief, the passion, that negative affects can be transformed. This implies a very dynamic view of affects, even those that freeze us in pain, in horror, or in mourning. There is a slightly depersonalizing effect of the negative or traumatic event, which actually allows for energetic forms of reaction. A lot of the ethics of affirmation is being used actually even in Spinoza-inspired psychotherapeutic movements, where the handling of the trauma and the traumatic material functions very differently from Freudian or Lacanian psychoanalysis. I put this on the side. So what is positive is the belief that the negative instance can be overturned, and what is negative about the negative effects is the effect of blockage, the effect of rigidification that comes as a result of blow or shock or pain. So affirmative virtues, affirmative passions increase your ability to act and interact. Negative actions diminish that ability. It is of the greatest importance, speaking in the Year of Grace 2015, that we do not psychologize the discussion about negative and positive affects. I know it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but we must not read this with identity politics. We need to read this in a Spinoza's mode of depersonalized affects. This is almost about a geometry of forces. It's about ontological forces. It's about being empowered to act. It's not about feeling good or feeling bad. Do not make the mistake of having the affective turn being reconnected to a liberal individual understanding of the subject. The subject here is nomadic, non-unitary, relational, open, transversal. It's not one, it's a group, it's a multitude, it's a herd, it's a tribe. So what is positive and affirmative is what empowers you to relate and take on the horrors of the world. What is negative is whatever makes you feel incapable of, scared, belittled, dimmed down, hesitating. Very much doses of Nietzsche here, very important on the will to power and the life force. So I think what is negative and what is being negated by negative passion is the power of life itself, the potentia of life as dynamic force and vital interconnections. What is being affirmed by affirmative passion is the positivity of that very life, which we do not contain and we do not possess. We merely inhabit it. This is the theory of affirmation and how it works, and you see the interconnection. Very quickly, the standard objection that has been made since Hegel to both monism and to Spinoza's philosophy is that there is a risk here of a passivity, if not of acquiescence. If we say that as critical intellectuals, we have to fight the very conditions that we inhabit, that we are part of the very problem that we're trying to solve, is there not a risk of acquiescence and complicity with the very conditions of the present? Is there not the danger of compromising ourselves with existing forms of capitalist innovations? Those of us who work in the university, do we ever get this distinct feeling that we're working for industry, that we're working for capital? The saturation of the civic space by the market economy ideology has really made the whole work of thinking index on profit motives that makes it so difficult to think otherwise. So again, see how the politics of immanence work. If you apply it immediately to your practice, you see the advantage of saying, okay, as an academic, as a professor, I'm paid for thinking and for being creative. And the more innovation we come up with, the better. But innovation is a term that is indexed on the market economy and on finance. So how do we resist that? And I think you will get this objection of acquiescence and complicity. You get it in Badiou's objection to Deleuze. You get it in Peter Hallward's objection to Deleuze. If you could be bothered, you can get bits of it in Zizek, but I don't consider that a serious thinker, so we put that on the side. So what work around this objection. Are we really in the politics of affirmation dealing only with rearrangements of existing conditions? Where do we place the geometry of dispossessions in this system? Think of the extent to which green capitalism today is using the very technique of the Gaia movements for the enhancement of corporate performance. Think of the Pope inviting Naomi Klein to a seminar on the climate change, which is going to be a sort of a hymn to life with a capital L. So is the appeal to ontological positivity not just a form of indifference to the concrete real world relations and experiences they were involved in? Is there not here a risk of dogmatism and abstractions? These are, as I repeat, Hegel's objection to Spinoza. They led to a rejection of Spinoza as some sort of mystic, or, as people often say, an aristocratic thinker that demands a lot of people to transcend, to transform, and does not respect the brutality of real power relations. Now, let me state my profound disagreement with these criticisms, and I will attempt to answer it. Nothing could be further from the truth that these caricatures of both Deleuze's notion of immanence and Spinoza's defense of monism. In many of his books on Spinoza, Deleuze addresses this issue of the danger of pacification. He argues, in fact, he rages against the beautiful souls, the great rhetoricians that are looking for global harmonies and do nothing about the dirt and the horrors of the world. What Deleuze calls for is almost the opposite, a radical immanence, being part of this, analyzing through cartographic rendering of power relations, analyze the very conditions that we are very critical of, and looking at this as a non-dialectical, non-antagonistic play of what he calls structures of differentiation, based on a praxis, and a praxis is an actualization of virtual possibilities in the real world. The whole point of the virtual, which is Deleuze's idea for possibilities for emancipation, liberation, change. The whole point of the virtual is it needs to be actualized. It calls for a praxis, an ethical praxis, which becomes the lead for a political praxis. And it is our ethics that guide our politics, and this is the key of the ethics of affirmation. Whereas Badiou accuses Deleuze of complicity with the system, Deleuze argues that he's producing an adequate cartography of the present conditions, following Foucault's analysis of power is a complex strategic situation at work in the most intimate as well as the most general formation of our truth. So we have here a cartographic method that is a form of doing justice to the complexities and horrors of the present. And this is a crucial point because Deleuze and Guattari's A Thousand Plateau has been adopted across the board as the anatomy of advanced capitalism. It is being taught in management schools, it's being taught in military academy, it's being taught across a broad range of institutions, except the universities that don't go near it, most university. And it is just a cheap sleight of hand to say, oh, you see, management schools, military schools, brokers are reading these thinkers, so these thinkers are complicitous with capitalism. Excuse me, this is really blaming the messages for the message. It is the case that a broad constituency of people are reading A Thousand Plateau because the anatomy of advanced capitalism that you get there is the correct one. It is absolutely spot on about the workings of advanced capitalism, which makes Hegelian Marxist reading looking like Jurassic Park. So wrong are they about the interrelation between technology, speeds of deterritorialization, and finance, to mention just one. So it is the adequacy of the cartographies that Deleuze and Guattari are providing of advanced capitalism, for instance, that makes their reading adopted across the board. It's not a form of complicity. It's a radical, critical cartography, adequate, that is to say, it resonates so it can be used across the board. Other crucial point in defense of Deleuze, so we've had his rejection of mystical pacification, embracing of parties of immanence, cartographies of power, the question of subjectivity. It really is in an age when the object ontologies in their very bad adaptational Latour are encouraging us to release any understanding of what constitutes a subjectivity. We get in Deleuze and Guattari, on the contrary, a rethinking of what constitutes subjectivization in our day and age. Without a theory of subjectivity, there cannot be a praxis, ethical, political praxis that can make a difference. We need, in fact, a subjectivity that can be revolutionary in the sense that it can overturn the conditions of the present, instituting affirmative forces, forces of affirmation, in an otherwise reterritorialized and rather mournful landscape. And affirmative politics of becoming calls for collectively framed disruptive actions to resist the codes and the overcodes of advanced capitalism. There is a Bergsonian philosophy of time that works through historical actualizations of the virtual and through new processes of subjectivation. So what we get from this is the idea that affirmative power, affirmative ethics, assumes, following Nietzsche, that humanity does not stem out of freedom, but rather that freedom is extracted out of the awareness of the conditions and limitations that frame our activity. Affirmation is about freedom from the burden of negativity by understanding the conditions of our bondage. So it's an epistemic understanding of the negative conditions that makes it possible for us to fight for freedom. And Spinoza is very, very much a thinker of freedom. There are many other things that I want to say about this, but my time is running out. So I want to give you quickly some examples of how this has worked out, and then you can go and look them up for yourself. How very generative, how very inspirational affirmative ethics can be. First example from postcolonial theory, think of the work of Edward Glissant and all the indigenous epistemology movements who are embracing a non-dialectic understanding of difference. I am not other than, I am other. I don't have, just because my legal code does not resemble the British common law code, it doesn't mean that I have no legal code. So the positivity of difference, the creolization of relation in postcolonial theory with a very dynamic understanding of time, a Bergsonian time continuum that challenges the authority of the past, and by challenging the authority of the past, challenges the authority of the original trauma to which we would have to be forever attached by multiple ties of negativity. Undo that negative bond, enter the discussion through multiple ecologies of becoming and positivity of difference, you get a different postcolonial theory and nomadism and of a more erratic and creative kind. Second example, environmental theory. As I said before, always been up there with Spinoza, now absolutely rampant in this age of the Anthropocene, the era in which the human becomes a negative geological force, the fact that we are part of nature, that we make one matter. What philosophy better than monism to help us understand why the earth, the sea, the air are not other, they are part of what we are. Deleuze and Guattari allow us to think the human, non-human continuum away from metaphysical dogmatic abstractions, radically imminent to what we could call, and I have called in my last book, multiple reconstructions of ways of being human. You will find multiple reconstructions of ways of being human in the work of disability studies, which has taken off beyond advocacy into I am other movement. You will find it in the radical pedagogic movement that I am involved with my dear colleague Vivian Buzalek, thinking radical pedagogics in a nature-culture continuum technologically mediated in the world of today. And you will find it in a multiplicity of new forms of humanities research, environmental humanities, digital humanities, that do not assume the centrality of either men as that white heterosexual male that Deleuze criticizes and feminism and others have criticized so eloquently, either man or of a humanistic understanding of the human. Multiple ways of becoming world together. Hard work, but also in some ways humble work. It's about here and now, but in our globally interconnected world, here and now stretch very, very far. And I think what you get with the ethics and politics of affirmation is a strong encouragement to dare to act, to reverse the conditions of power in the most intimate, closest instances, in the here and now of our practice. And there are so many of us that we can hope that some of it will have an impact. And I think this impact is effective, ethical, political, collective, transversal, and all of that simultaneously. This is what I had to tell you. I wish I could have been there. Looking forward to the questions. And I wish you really all the best. And stay well, and lucky you to be in that amazing place. And that is South Africa, that is Cape Town. Take care.